I wanted to do a series of interviews with white women 65 and older who had been a part of civil rights and anti-racist organizing. In large part, I wanted to do this because I remember growing up and hearing my mother talk about some of her experience in that space, and it was really important to me in terms of how I thought to move forward in the world. I don't think that we have an anti-racist world, and I think that we have a white supremacist world that requires all hands on deck all the time and constant learning from our history, from each other. I didn't want the stories of these women to go unheard. I've collected them in a series of interviews, and thank you so much for taking time to listen to them.
Hi, so I am interviewing Ellen Isaacs, and I'm just going to ask a few questions for the project. How did you first get involved in civil rights and anti-racist work, and what kind of work did that look like for you?
Well, I went to college in the 60s, and so before that I really had virtually no political awareness. But I was at the University of Chicago, and people were going from there to some of the early summer projects in the South, which I couldn't do because I was 17 and you still needed your parents' permission. I knew I couldn't get their permission, so
yeah.
That was out. But I did get involved in demonstrations against the war in Vietnam, mainly, I would say. And living on the south side of Chicago, of course, began to learn something about segregation and poverty and the university's injustices in the neighborhood. But then I went to medical school in New York, and that's where I actually became more politically involved, partly because I had a roommate who came from an old left family, and she introduced me to some left-wing students. And also, I was at NYU Bellevue, where the contrasts were just stark between the way patients were treated in the private hospitals and the way they were treated at Bellevue, and how they were divided by race and class. And also my fellow students at that time, we were only about 10% women, and there were no black students whatsoever. There was maybe one 3 years ahead of me and one 3 years behind me. But that was also clearly very racist. But there was a student who was 2 or 3 years ahead of me who was a member of the Progressive Labor Party, and he started a discussion group. And then when students, by the time I went to medical school in 65, there were a lot more protests going on all over the country. So we began having all kinds of activities and protests at the medical school, some of which were participating in marches about Vietnam and in support of the civil rights struggle, but also about conditions in the hospital. The shortage of workers, and the mistreatment of workers and patients at Bellevue, and human experimentation. I was basically coming to understand through the regular discussions that we had that the problems of war and racism were really related to capitalism. And so by the time I was a senior in medical school, I joined the Progressive Labor Party. And we were also very active in a citywide group called the Medical Committee for Human Rights. So then we allied with students and doctors and workers from hospitals all around the city. So that's how it started.
That makes sense. And what I guess I was also curious, what was one of the most difficult aspects of being involved in that work? What was one of the most difficult aspects to being involved in that work?
I'm not sure I could say it was difficult, because the stuff we were seeing was so amazing, that amazingly awful, that it was very, it sort of allowed you to go through it. I think people that didn't get involved in fighting against the racism and the segregation and everything of the way medical care was presented, then they had to develop a very sort of outlook that would justify it. You know, they had to feel very divorced in a human way and also in an ideological way from what they were seeing. And, you know, I mean, there were even terms that were used. Some people described their patients at Bellevue as SPOSES, which stands for subhuman piece of shit.
Oh, my God.
Right. So, I mean, you either had to develop an ideological system that justified what you were seeing, or you had to feel like you were involved in allying with people and fighting back. So, personally, for me, the biggest thing that happened was that the Medical Committee for Human Rights, inspiration from the Progressive Labor Party, took up the issue of experimentation on the children at Willowbrook. Willowbrook was a school for the mentally retarded in Staten Island, where the chairman of pediatrics at NYU, Saul Krugman, became famous for developing the vaccine against hepatitis B. But the way that they did that was to inject the new children who came in there with infected feces in order to give them hepatitis so that they could study it, or then try to, you know, protect them by giving them the vaccine. So, although at this point that experiment is listed in the books as one of the most awful examples of racist human experimentation, at that time it was applauded and lauded, and he was very famous. And so the Medical Committee for Human Rights took this up as a citywide issue and started publishing papers about it. And it also coincided with a TV reporter's expose of the conditions at Willowbrook. So it really caught on as a popular issue. And eventually the student council at NYU demanded that Krugman be forced to publicly debate what he was doing. And so the medical school administration said that they would only do this on one condition, that the person to debate him be me. And you have to understand that at this time, the reason they picked me was threefold. One was because I was one of the very few women around. At that time, I was a resident, and I was one of two women residents. Second thing is that I was a communist, which made me just a crazy lunatic. So, and the third thing was that I was very shy. I am no longer very shy, but at that time I was very shy. I very rarely spoke up in public, and it was generally a timid person still. So they were sure that if they took this crazy woman, timid person, and put her up against Saul Krugman, that it would be a wipeout. But I said to my comrades, no way in a million years would I do this. And they said, of course you're going to do it. So So I did it. But what made it easy was that I completely had right on my side. I mean, we had all the data, and, you know, we knew very well what had gone on. And, you know, so his only defense was the end justifies the means, which, you know, this was not a very tenable defense. So I would say it was a wipeout, but I won. And that was, of course, the end.
That you did that.
I know. To me, it was totally amazing. I mean, if there hadn't been 20 people telling me, of course you're going to do it, then, I mean, I couldn't get out of it. Let's put it that way. And
what was the crowd like?
It was an auditorium filled up to the gills. And, I mean, I think basically it ranged from supporters to people that didn't understand previously what had happened. So, you know, by the end, once they heard what had happened and how sort of indefensible it was, that they were all on our, you know, basically almost all on my side, our side by the end. And they actually had two famous professors of medical ethics as fillers who they didn't really understand what had been going on. And even they ended up, you know, having to concede. So that was, you know, probably one of the most thrilling days of my life in the end, but it also, it was the end of my career at NYU, of course. But, which
Because you did that?
Well, I mean, that was the end of my second year of residency, and they did not give me after that came a fellowship, which, of course, I did not get there.
I see.
But, so, you know, after that, I worked at various medical institutions, and we had campaigns about minority admissions to medical school and about unionization of doctors and building unity with healthcare workers and, you know, many, and then campaigns about exposing the Shockley-Hernstein bell curve intellectual racism that came along after that. So it was kind of a continuation of many campaigns. But I think, you know, what I don't know. I'm just going on. I didn't know if you had other questions specifically to ask.
I did. I guess you've sort of spoken to one of the questions I had was what was one of the most rewarding aspects to the work. I think you're talking about those rewarding aspects about being able to stand up for what is right and just. Are there other aspects to speaking up and speaking out that were rewarding to you?
Well, I think that I would say two things. One was that I came to really understand, I think, how the world works and how racism works, because I think the Progressive Labor Party, to my mind, you know, is an imperfect organization, as all are, but what it has is, I think, the best understanding of how capitalism works and how racism is the most important thing that's used to divide people and weaken workers and students against one another. And so I think that perspective has been very helpful to me. And of course, also just the being in an international organization, a comradely international organization, is a fantastic thing because you experience comradeship and support and friendship in a way that is rare in capitalist society. I mean, almost any city or many countries that I go to, I can look up comrades and have instant companionship. And also, much more so than any doctor, I know working class people. You know, I don't just have friends who are other professionals as most bourgeois professionals tend to do. And I think, you know, it's really armed me against what I think is a very unfortunate development of the last 30 years or so, which is, well, it isn't really new, but it's been revived, which is identity politics and nationalism. I mean, the tendency of people to feel they have to separate themselves from each other, which may have a place in terms of Black people or any minority getting together to discuss with each other how they've experienced things. But I think ultimately we have to fight back in a multiracial way because we have to overcome these barriers that have been put between us. And of course, we'll never be strong enough if we're isolated from each other. Mm-hmm. And I see that just getting stronger and stronger of people dividing themselves into little groups and deceiving themselves about who their friends are based on ethnicity as opposed to class or what people do. So, and I think, like, we're one of the few groups that looks upon nationalism and identity politics as being a reactionary and harmful outlook, you know.
Yeah. I definitely have been, you know, part of why I wanted to do this project was also feeling really saddened by sort of the rhetoric around nationalism and how it's grown in this country, and but also other countries. I spent some time as a child. My father was in the military, so I lived in Germany when the Berlin Wall came down, and I think traveling in Europe and recognizing that there's been an undercurrent of nationalism in countries for a long time, but it feels as if it's having a moment of resurgence and sort of an ahistorical understanding that a lot of the proponents of it seem to traffic in. But I did also want to ask if you had any lessons that you learned at that time in your organizing, especially as a white person doing anti-racist work. What was a big lesson that you learned?
Well, I think the main thing that we have to understand is that racism doesn't just hurt the people at whom it's most acutely aimed. You know, in other words, racism was basically invented to justify slavery. It really, there was an anti-Black racism is what I'm talking about because it's the most important in the world. It was really invented in the 1600s, 1700s, and then, of course, perfected in the United States to justify slavery, but it didn't just massively hurt Black slaves, it also hurt poor white people who were made allowed to be one degree higher in wages and freedom than Black people were, but were then terribly separated from them so they could also be incredibly exploited. And so I think, I mean, what we have today is not only identity politics, we have this idea of white privilege, which makes white people think either that they are responsible for racism, which they're not. The ruling class is responsible for racism. I mean, even if white people have been inculcated with racist ideas, it didn't come from them. It's not part of nature, and it doesn't benefit them. It hurts them. And so I think it's, you know, very important to have this understanding that racism hurts everybody. And the other idea of white privilege is if you don't think you're very guilty because of racism, and therefore you feel like you can't unite with, you can't treat people that aren't white as equals, you know, as people that you can share leadership with, as people that you can be criticized by and criticize, that you just don't treat each other as full human beings because you're so guilty just about being white, and or that you can't criticize nationalist ideas. I don't just think about nationalism as white supremacy kind of nationalism, but also talking about things like national liberation movements, because
yeah.
we've seen a century of national liberation struggles, not one of which has ever ended up benefiting people, because it's just ended up creating new capitalist countries with different color or different ethnicity rulers, and the poor people, whether you're talking about, you know, El Salvador or Nicaragua or South Africa or Algeria, every country you can think of that's undergone national liberation struggles, the poor working people are just as badly off as they were before.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it's but many people have the attitude, well, you come from the white imperialist country, so you are not allowed to say anything, you know.
No.
And so
well,
I think
that's unhelpful.
As a party, we try very hard and we succeed in having a very integrated leadership and that involves men and women, because we need to talk about all these issues and we need to demonstrate that people can act and accept leadership from each other, and that ethnicity is not what you should be judged by. It's by the content of what you say and what you do. But, you know, I've been doing some work in recent years with college students and stuff, and I find these ideas are very difficult. Everybody's segregated into different groups based on their nationality or their color or their race, and it's very hard to bridge those gaps.
Yeah. I guess a way that I've thought about it at times, because I do agree that some notions of white privilege lead to people being destabilized by guilt and being ineffective, which actually isn't anti-racist at all. But I sort of think of it sometimes as there are moments in a white supremacist culture of white advantage and spaces that I can move in, or places that I can have a seat at the table and advocate for a more just world or a less racist world that some of my friends who are not white might not have the same access to. I guess that's one way.
Yeah, I think it's the difference between you have to be able to separate the differences between what happens as individuals and what happens as a group. In other words, it's true that if I'm a white person and I'm stopped by a cop for a broken taillight or something, I'm less likely to be killed, injured,
yeah.
threatened, or even given a ticket.
Yeah.
And that's very true. I don't think you want to deny that people are treated differently because of race. But that's different from saying that white people as a group are benefiting from racism. Because as a group, we are not benefiting from racism. By saying that I may be likely to be treated just as an ordinary human being and you're not, should not be thought of as a privilege, first of all. But as a group, not ruling class white people, but ordinary white people, be it teachers or doctors or cafeteria workers or unemployed workers, all levels of white working people are not benefiting from racism, because the standards of health and education and wages are lowered for everybody by virtue of racism. So I think you have to make that distinction. I think people get very confused about that if they think that as an individual in everyday ways, life may be easier for you as a white person, which is true, that means that white people benefit from racism, and we're not benefiting from it.
I think that the way that you frame it makes sense, because I guess it depends on sort of what the marker is, but certainly in terms of a healthier, more just world, I don't think anyone stands to benefit from racism, even if in individual moments, or even by things like wealth accumulation or home ownership. I guess I do find some value in looking at those distinctions, but I guess it's how you measure benefiting. I did want to ask one final question, which is what advice would you give young people today, and young white women in particular, who want to engage in civil rights and anti-racist organizing?
Well, I would make sure that you have friends and coworkers and co-organizers from various communities, not just other white people. Don't go out and join Surge. But I think also you need to understand that any reforms that you win are going to be temporary unless they are part of a long-range struggle to change the system. So that as you're involved in, you know, immediate struggles at your school or community, that you be looking to understand the world in a broader way and, you know, look to think about how capitalism is involved in this and look to join an organization that has a long-range outlook, because every reform you win is going to be taken back under the system. I mean, even the civil rights movement won certain reforms, but the actual wages and living conditions, and probably even things like voting rights, which I don't think of as very important, but all of these things are, and segregation in schools, they're all now as bad as they were 50 years ago. Even if very overt things like segregated drinking fountains are gone. But segregated neighborhoods, segregated schools, lower class, you know, worse schools, worse indices of wealth, everything's as bad as it was before. So, and that's because basically the system didn't change and found ways of reversing what small gains were won.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking time to speak with me, and I will let you know when we share this, and I really think that it's useful for folks to hear these stories. So thank you so much for taking time with me today.
And I just, if you don't mind my, an advertisement.
Sure.
A friend of mine and I, we think this issue is so important, so we started a blog called multiracialunity.org with many historical articles and analyses of the present about racism, and so people are invited to check it out.
Oh, great. And can you tell me the URL one more time?
MultiracialUnity, all one word, .org.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you again for speaking with me, and have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.